Okay, so I'm going to talk about some aspects of the secular evolution of coupled planet disk systems. Much of this work has been done with Steve Lubow from Baltimore. We were able to work on a little more of this problem while we were here. I'm very grateful to the organizers of this program. So the kind of system we have in mind is a protoplanetary system in a phase in which the gaseous disk is still very much present, and one or more giant planets has formed in the disk, and they're massive enough to open substantial gaps. So we imagine that the masses of the planets are comparable to or approaching the mass of the disk. Now, for Jupiter in its current orbit, the dynamical timescale is roughly on the order of 10 years. A characteristic secular timescale for the protoplanetary system can be very crudely estimated as being longer by a factor of the characteristic mass ratio of the star to the planet. So very roughly 10 to the 4 years, and that's something like the timescale on which Jupiter and Saturn are perturbing each other's orbits through non-resonant perturbations. Another timescale of the protoplanetary system is the viscous timescale on which the surface density of the disk is rearranged, and that's the timescale on which the gap-opening planets are supposed to migrate through it. That may be as long as the lifetime of the system, or order 10 to the 7 years. Now, it's true that these two timescales may not be as cleanly separated as I've suggested here, but for the purposes of this talk, I want to neglect any aspects of accretion and migration to try to focus on what might happen on secular timescales and how do the eccentricity and inclination of the protoplanetary system evolve. And perhaps because I have something of a warped imagination, I find it easier to think about inclination and will, can I write that one up? focus on that case. Actually, I'm probably on somewhat safer ground here as there are fewer observational results and also fewer numerical simulations, although they will come in the near future. They're being done right now. Now, in the literature, you'll find the idea that the eccentricity and inclination of a gap-opening companion can be both excited and at the same time damped by resonant interactions with the disk. So surrounding the orbit of the planet are a host of resonances of various kinds, Lindblad, vertical, and eccentric resonances, which even to the first order in E and I cause those quantities to evolve. Now, Goldreich and Tremaine, thinking mainly about moons interacting with planetary rings, concluded that the net effect of these resonances is to damp the eccentricity of the companion. And later, Baudry, Goldreich, and Tremaine found that, on the contrary, the inclination of the companion would be excited on balance through these resonant interactions. And recently, Goldreich and Sari proposed that the eccentricity can also be excited. The balance can be tipped in favor of growth if the eccentric co-rotation resonances are at least partially saturated. This is a nonlinear effect, which Steve and I were able to calculate in some detail, and those calculations have been recently confirmed and extended numerically by Frédéric Massé. An obvious question is whether these effects of growth of eccentricity and inclination, or damping, if that's the case, can be seen in planet disk simulations. And is it as simple as putting in a planet on a slightly eccentric or inclined orbit and measuring the E dot or I dot? Just a word about the philosophy of our approach here, because you're going to hear a number of talks today about beautiful numerical simulations of planet disk interactions. I think there is still a role for analytic approaches in this subject. Although limited in scope, they provide at least an interpretative framework within which to understand the results of simulations. And they can be used to isolate different aspects of the physical problem. And by understanding the dependence on parameters, which comes through actual equations, you can suggest targeted numerical experiments to do. And also, it's primarily through the analytic approaches that we make a connection with the important legacy from the great mathematicians who worked on celestial mechanics in previous centuries. In fact, what's what's needed, as I'll argue in this problem, is a sort of continuum version of celestial mechanics which describes how eccentricity and inclination evolve in systems containing a continuous disk. So what's known about that problem? Well, a gaseous disk is able to propagate disturbances by means of a multitude of restoring forces. It's also able to damp disturbances through simple viscosity or through nonlinear dissipative mechanisms, or indeed through interaction of the disturbances with turbulence, if that's present in the disk. Now, regarding the case of inclination, there's no reason, of course, why a gaseous disk should be rigidly tilted, like a rigid body, but it can become warped to have a differential inclination. And warped accretion disks have been studied for nearly 30 years. It's a very complicated subject, and there are various regimes. The one that's most likely to apply to protoplanetary systems is the one analyzed by Papaloisiou and Lin. And the basic result there is that inclination propagates through a gaseous disk as a non-dispersive wave at approximately half the sound speed. It's a bending wave. And the warp is damped by viscosity. It's also damped, incidentally, by MHD turbulence, if that's present in the disk. We were able to show that in numerical simulations with Ulf Torkelsen. Self-gravity is important for these bending waves only if the Thomeray parameter is of order unity, as a sort of a natural criterion. Much less is known about the propagation of eccentricity through disks, but certainly, at least in linear theory, eccentricity can propagate, this time as a dispersive wave, generally much slower than the sound speed. But the damping or excitation of eccentricity in a gaseous disk is a very subtle issue. And for example, if you do a calculation in two dimensions or three dimensions, you'll get a different answer. And also, if you treat the disk as being literally viscous, rather than trying to model the turbulent stresses in a somewhat more realistic way with some relaxation timescale, again, you'll get a different answer, even as to the sign of this effect. Another thing to watch out for is that self-gravity is important for the propagation of eccentricity through a gaseous disk, even when the Thomeray parameter is quite large. My contribution to this has been largely to derive some nonlinear theories of eccentricity and inclination in disks through an asymptotic procedure that reduces the original three-dimensional problem in a systematic way to one-dimensional evolutionary equations which can be applied relatively straightforwardly. And for example, the recent work, which I haven't published yet, is a nonlinear version of this theory of warp disks in the protoplanetary regime, the kind of nonlinear Schrödinger equation describing this propagation. Now, these theories are, to a large extent, untested in numerical simulations, but it would be very good to test it. And I would invite anyone who's doing planet disk simulations to look at the propagation of warps and eccentric disturbances through disks, and there are some test problems that can be invented for that. Now, regarding the secular dynamics of the planetary system without a disk, this is a well-understood problem, and it is at least adequately described by the classical Laplace-Lagrange theory, which will be familiar to many of you. So very briefly, on secular timescales, planets can be thought of as continuous rings, and circular rings that are mutually inclined exert a gravitational torque on each other, which each one causes the other one to precess. And if we use L to be the unit tilt vector perpendicular to a ring and introduce this complex inclination variable that I'll use later, the magnitude of W, which I assume to be small, is just the inclination angle, and the phase of W tells you about the precession of the ring. Then the Laplace-Lagrange theory just amounts really to writing down an angular momentum equation for the ring I. J is the orbital angular momentum. This is the rate of change of tilt. And each ring is coupled to the other ones by these gravitational torques with coupling coefficients that depend on the masses and the radii of the rings. And that's a simple linear dynamical system which is customarily analyzed into normal modes. And a similar thing occurs for eccentricity. Now, returning to the planet disk system, what's needed is to generalize this idea to allow for, in this case, inclination to propagate in the disk. So the disk will also have a tilt, a complex tilt, which is a function of radius and time. That is, the disk in general will be warped. Well, we can write down an angular momentum equation for the disk. Again, this is really the linear theory. So this is the angular momentum equation. And we have to allow for an internal torque, G, in the disk. And this is where the complicated hydrodynamics of warped disks comes into play. This torque is really a Reynolds stress. It's mediated by horizontal shearing epicyclic motions in the disk, which are driven by the warping of the disk, dW by dr. Those motions undergo viscous decay, alpha is the viscosity parameter, and also apsidal precession. Now, if you just look at the terms in red, you see we have the makings of a wave equation here, and that's what gives rise to the result that the warp propagates through the disk at half the speed of sound. Okay, so putting this all together now, we can write down a dynamical system which governs the linear inclination dynamics of the protoplanetary system. So it's really just the horizontal components of the angular momentum equation for each planet interacting with the other planets and with the disk, angular momentum equation of the disk interacting with planets and through self-gravity with the remainder of the disk. There's this equation for the internal torque, which contains all of the hydrodynamics. And then there are boundary conditions that say that the hydrodynamic stresses cannot be communicated across the edge of the disk. Well, by construction, this system conserves the horizontal angular momentum of the system, which is a quantity of first order in W, the tilt. But of more interest is a quantity of second order, this thing minus LZ. This is really the angular momentum deficit, which is a familiar concept in celestial mechanics. If we take a ring initially horizontal that's spinning and we turn it through a small angle I, then we reduce the vertical component of the angular momentum by this factor. So the quantity I squared or W squared appears here as an angular momentum deficit. So these two terms are straightforwardly the angular momentum deficit of the planets and of the disk system. There is, however, an additional contribution. This is really the negative angular momentum which is stored in the bending wave in the disk. And strictly speaking, that needs to be taken into account. So what this thing is, it's a positive definite measure of the bending disturbance in the whole protoplanetary system. And in the absence of viscosity, alpha, this quantity is conserved in the secular dynamics. But with some viscosity, it will decay monotonically, and that's because the disturbance is being dissipated because of warping of the disk. Now, all this neglects the effect of mean motion resonances, which is what I started with, but we can include those as well. Now, there are many resonances expected in the disk because, of course, the disk occupies a continuous range of radii and many commensurabilities will occur, even for a single planet. Now, the analysis of Baudry, Goldreich, and Tremain, which was later clarified for a gaseous disk by Lubow, indicates that at the location of each inclination resonance, a resonant torque is exchanged. This is one way to interpret it. So as far as the disk is concerned, the torque is localized in the neighborhood of the resonance, and the torque depends on the relative inclination of the planet and disk at the location of the resonance. S is just a dimensionless parameter, either positive or negative, that quantifies the strength of the resonances. And when this is factored in, we now see that this angular momentum deficit can now either grow or decay. It always decays because of viscous damping in the disk, but in principle it can grow through the effect of mean motion resonances. But we have to look at the sign and magnitude of this sum over resonances. Okay, now that linear system can be analyzed into normal modes, much as is done for the Laplace-Lagrange theory. The meaning of the normal mode is really a rigidly precessing pattern. So the frequency of the mode is just the precession rate of the whole pattern. And the eigenfunction tells you about the distribution of inclination in the system as it processes. And this has to be solved numerically in this problem. There's always a trivial mode in which the whole system is just tilted through some angle. That doesn't do anything. And in fact, there's an infinite number of modes because the disk supports an arbitrary number of bending oscillations. But what's of most interest are the lowest order modes, which have the lowest frequencies and the lowest damping rates. So in fact, if the precession frequency, if the precession period is long compared to the time it takes a bending wave to travel across the disk, then the disk can behave almost like a rigid body in that mode. And by reducing the amount of warping in the disk, one can reduce the amount of damping of the mode altogether. So here are some examples of modes for a simple model of Jupiter at 5 AU in a disk with a gap, and the disk extends out to 100 AU. These are the three lowest order modes, and I'm plotting the vertical displacement on an arbitrary scale. So as promised, the precession periods of these modes are of the order of 10 to the 4 years, and the damping timescales are not much longer than that. This is for alpha is 0.005. And this calculation includes the effect of mean motion resonances. So in this case, the viscous damping overcomes the potential growth of inclination through mean motion resonances. All of these modes are damped. And one would conclude, at least for these parameters, that the system would retain, would become coplanar on a timescale of some million years. One can also look at the case of a hot Jupiter in a disk extending from the 2-to-1 resonance out to, say, 100 AU. And here also, the timescales for precession and decay are similar. Now, notice that in all of these modes, the outer part of the disk is significantly warped, and that's why these modes decay. The timescale of the mode is so long that the disk cannot behave like a rigid body, whereas the inner part of the disk, which has good communication through bending waves, is tilted almost like a rigid body. Okay, now previously showed that the potential growth of inclination, relative inclination, through mean motion resonances depends on this summation over the resonant torques. And you see that the resonances are weighted not only by the surface density, but also by the relative inclination squared of the planet and the disk at the resonant location. So this figure shows the strengths of the various resonances. Some are positive and some are negative. And this has to be, I've just shown the ones that are further than 0.1 planet radii away from it. Now, when Borderi, Goldreich, and Tremaine did their calculation, they assumed that the rings would remain, the ring system, the disk, that is, would remain essentially flat, coplanar. So they did a straightforward sum over these resonances and terminating the sum at the edge of the gap where the surface density goes to zero. And so that sum leads you to conclude that the inclination will grow. When we calculated the global modes of this system, including the warping and the mean motion resonances, as I just showed, you do get a different sum. And also the viscous damping of the mode in the disk, this effect typically prevails over the potential growth mechanism through mean motion resonances, unless the viscosity is extremely small. Now, what would happen in a time-dependent calculation? For example, if one were to take a flat disk with a planet that's carved out a gap in it and tilt the planet with respect to the disk. Well, at least on the basis of this rather simple theory, what you might see for the inclination of the planet over some tens of thousands of orbits might be something like this. And See, what happens is that the initial condition of a flat disk and a tilted planet excites many modes of the coupled planet-disk system, and they have different frequencies and damping rates, so there'll be a complicated evolution. Certainly the first thing that happens is that the inclination should start to fall, but that's just because the angular momentum deficit is being transferred in an essentially conservative way to the disk, and later it can come back. So it's more sensible perhaps to monitor the angular momentum deficit that shows the fractional change in that quantity over the same period. So if you recall, this quantity can only grow through the effect of mean motion resonances while it damps because of viscosity. Now in this case, this quantity decays over long timescales. And actually what's happening is that in the course of the secular evolution, the relative orientation of the planet and disk change in such a way that the net effect of the mean motion resonances changes from inclination growth to inclination damping. That's why there's an oscillation here. But also the viscous decay due to warping in the disk contributes to the declining of this quantity. Now, this is what might happen if you allowed the planet to evolve in a fully dynamical way. It's also possible to do a calculation where you just fix the planet on an inclined orbit and then try to measure the forces and deduce the rate of change of inclination from that. That's going to constrain the system in a rather artificial way, and you will excite modes in the disk, but it's likely to give different and, to be honest, erroneous results for the rate of change of inclination. And by analogy, similar behavior can be expected for eccentricity. That is, if you put an eccentric planet in a circular disk, one of the things that should happen is that the planet should transfer angular momentum deficit to the disk. The disk will want to become eccentric. So initially, there should be a strong negative E dot. That's not really the E dot that we're trying to measure. It makes more sense to monitor this kind of quantity. So just to summarize the key points and try to raise some topics for discussion, eccentricity and inclination can be regarded as shared properties of the planet-disk system. There is a quantity, an angular momentum deficit, which strictly speaking includes a contribution from waves in the disk. And in the case of inclination, this is a positive definite measure of the bending disturbance in the whole protoplanetary system. The quantity is useful because it's conserved in the secular exchanges between the planets and the disk. And whether it grows or decays can be used to quantify this competition that exists between the potential growth through mean motion resonances and dissipation occurring in the disk. So the original calculations of E dot and I dot for an orbiting companion that opens a gap in the disk do actually need to be revised in general. And that's when the dynamical response of the disk is taken into account. That's for two reasons. One is that when inclination, for example, enters the disk system, then it's damped there. And similarly for eccentricity, although it may possibly even be excited in the disk. But furthermore, once the disk responds by becoming warped or eccentric, this changes the relative weighting of all of the resonant torques, and that changes the conclusion as to the sum over resonances. So I've mainly discussed the case of inclination. I think the case of eccentricity is actually much more difficult and more subtle, I certainly haven't reached any conclusions on that one myself. I think the dynamics of eccentricity in gaseous disks is a very subtle problem, and as I've mentioned already, the results of 2D and 3D calculations can be expected to differ. Also, those that treat the disk as being literally viscous rather than turbulent are likely to give different answers. That is, a straightforward Navier-Stokes disk actually excites eccentricity rather than damping it. Also, self-gravity may be important in this problem, even if the tomb ray parameter is not of order unity. And something I've wondered about for some time is, if you do a simulation in cylindrical polar coordinates, is there a built-in bias for circular orbits that may limit the extent to which eccentricity can grow in the disk? And finally, if we want to look for this effect that Goldreich and Sari have proposed, that through the saturation of eccentric co-rotation resonances, eccentricity of planets can grow through interaction with the disk, then this is going to require a rather high numerical resolution. And the reason for that is that these co-rotation resonances are very narrow. If you don't resolve the libration width of the co-rotation resonance, then you won't see this saturation effect. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Fred.
I'm not sure about intuitive, no.
Can you repeat the question first?
My question was, is there a simple way of explaining or an intuitive understanding for the different way in which eccentricity, in which self-gravity plays a role for eccentricity perturbations as opposed to inclination?
Well, generally, the tomb ray parameter can be thought of as comparing the effects of the self-gravitational restoring forces with the acoustic or epicyclic restoring forces. So for most waves in the disk, the tomb ray parameter gives a good measure of the relative effect of self-gravity. M equals 1 density waves are different because they're particularly slow waves. And that's just a peculiar property of the point mass potential, that you can have waves that are much slower than all the other waves in the disk over extended regions of space. And so in that case, the self-gravity is relatively more important than it would be for other waves. The case of bending waves is more difficult. Bending waves in a Keplerian disk they involve, although you might think of them as mainly vertical motions, they're actually strongly coupled to horizontal motions through a resonance with, it's essentially a Lindblad resonance. The vertical motion couples resonantly to horizontal epicyclic motions. And so actually, they propagate faster than you might have thought. And self-gravity is only as important as measured by the tomb ray parameter.
It seems to me that some of these results would depend on the size of the disk and how you're treating the boundaries. Like at the outer boundary in these calculations, you know, how are you treating the edge of the disk?
Okay.
I mean, is it a good reflector for for waves, or is there a? I mean, it seems to me that you could get a lot of dissipation at a boundary, at an external boundary, if waves enter that region and go nonlinear.
Okay, that's a good point. So generally speaking, waves cannot be expected to propagate across the whole extent of a gaseous disk. There are so many ways in which they can dissipate en route. What's different about these waves is that they have a very long wavelength. And in fact, the wavelength typically exceeds the size of the disk. So, like here. The wavelength is of order the size of the disk. So this wave has no problem in propagating across the disk and reflecting from the edge.
Well, that's because you'd assume that this disk is 100 AU. That's what I'm pointing out.
Okay.
I mean, in other words, if you have a disk whose dimensions are large,
yes,
then these waves shorten, just like any of these waves do, right? and eventually they would not, you know, they would, it seems to me, you know, not be able to return any information. So, I mean, you'd still get damping, but I'm wondering, you know, whether your waveforms and everything would be the same.
Okay.
And in particular, how they feed back on the vertical resonances may be different.
Is there a density scale like that?
That's true.
It's a scale. Could you speed up the
radio? Sorry, I didn't hear.
What's the scale for the horizontal?
I don't understand. What scale length of what?
Of the wave.
No, that is the wavelength. It is a global mode.
It does depend on surface density. Right.
Yeah,
it depends on the square root of the surface density.
Certainly it is possible. If you make the disk larger than this, then it could develop many wavelengths. And in this case, the size of the disk does have an important role, but if the disk is suppose it were much smaller than this, then the outer disk can easily maintain bending wave communication, behave almost rigidly in this dynamics. There's very little warping, and then these modes can survive for much longer.
Well, like Doug says, I think it depends on the scale height at the outer rim. If the density drops off, then the wavelengths shorten as the density drops off. Right, and so if it drops off slowly, I mean the disk may not be huge in total extent, but it may have a very, you know, gentle sloping off, so that the waves can get into that region. It seems to me that could be important in the overall shape of this mode that you're.
Yeah, I think that's a valid point, and obviously disks generally don't have a clear outer edge unless they're truncated by binary companion or something. And yes, that's certainly something worth investigating. But the assumption behind all of these analyses is that these are global modes with a scale large compared to the scale height.
Jack, final metaphor.
How does the character of the interaction depend on the ratio of the vertical motion of the planet to the scale height of the disk? And in particular, if you just start with a inclination that's small compared to the scale height of the disk, is interaction with the disk a viable way of exciting a large inclination?
Well, that's a very good question. I haven't analyzed that regime, so I don't know what would happen for such small inclination.
Okay, I'm going to ask a silly question to give an example to the students. But so there is something that I really don't understand. You said that if the viscosity is really low, then the mean motion resonances win and the inclination can be excited. And this is what I don't understand, because my experience is only for particle disks where there is no viscosity. And what happens if you put an inclined planet in a cold particle disk is that the disk gets warped as here. But then, because of the differential precession of the particles, the warped disk becomes a thick disk, a hot disk. And therefore, it cannot give back the inclination to the planet. So what happens is you start with an inclined planet relative to a thick disk. At the end, you find a zero inclination planet in the middle of a thick disk. Okay. And I would expect that in a very low viscosity case, the gaseous disk behaves more or less like a particle disk. So where comes the difference from?
Well, the disk is, it doesn't, okay, the disk is able to propagate the bending disturbance very rapidly, as I say, at approximately half the sound speed. It's really through the effects of pressure and also through this coupling to resonant coupling to horizontal motions that I mentioned earlier. So it's very effective in.
You never have a loss of volume because of the pressure curve?
No, I mean, the worst that can happen, well, you see, the the disk is actually almost able to behave like a rigid body. It's only if it's very extended that it starts to warp a little bit. But it's very difficult to get into a regime where this warping would be so extreme as to lead to a breakup.
It means the bath is still very small, even if it was possible. Another way to look at this warp, if you start with a disk, flat disk, basically, you have already put a lot of power into all the other eigenfrequencies that are small wave. And if you want to look at it in terms of this eigenfrequency. So what you see is a whole lot of emotion that's due to the fact that the way you started, you put a lot of, you take a Fourier spectrum of it, you've got lots of amplitudes at all these short wavelength modes, and you just don't see the warp, but the warp can still be there. If you run such a thing long enough, you should see the same kind of thing. It's just that you have this big fat disk depending on the way you start. That's your idea.
Yeah, I mean, the particle disks are going to behave very differently from gaseous disks in this dynamics. Let's see.
Give it phase.
I just want to comment that we analyzed similar things, but not in the same way. We sort of did order of magnitude estimates of what happens to these apsidal waves, which is the same thing but with eccentricity, as it propagates through the disk. And we concluded, similar to your result, that the wavelength is indeed extremely large, so it may be reasonable that the waves are trapped in the disk. And we get similar results to what you have. It's all in our eccentricity paper.
Yes.
Similar result to what you have, that initially you can have a sharp decay in the eccentricity as long as it, on the time scale that it takes you to build the perturbation in the disk. But then the long-term evolution is only given by the damping, by the viscosity in the disk. So if there is no viscosity, if these waves cannot dump, you don't have any secular evolution due to these waves which are trapped in the disk. So it's a very similar result to the inclination case you're investigating.
Okay, thank you.
I have two questions. So maybe because I'm genetic, maybe I missed this, but what are the surface density distributions you used for this, for these models?
This is based on a minimum mass solar net.
Yeah, and it's R to the minus 1.5 for the surface density. Okay.
Apart from the gap, obviously.
Of course.
Okay, let me pose two questions to people here. One is, how difficult is it to numerically simulate this type of verify this type of theory? And the other is, ultimately, how can we observe inclined, what is the prospect of observing inclined planetary systems?
May have a very simple answer to your first question, depending on your computer speed.
I mean, it's obvious. I mean, that's the reason why simulations have been primarily done in 2D, because 3D adds another dimension, and you get, with the present machines, as we have done, and also Gordon was participating, of course, in this, it takes months, typically, to do one simulation. Yes, you need to evolve for secular or viscous timescales, at least, if you have a viscosity, and those timescales, as you said, are very, very long. And so it's, I mean, presently, I think, unless you make some approximations, it's not really viable to do this only with very simple physics, and then you want to have more physics as well. But can I just take the opportunity to ask a question also? I mean, you mentioned the eccentricity, which may be rising, be damped, and so on, depending on several things you point out here. But isn't it the case that if you, let's say, assume a given physical viscous model, that you would get, you must get eventually a definite answer there? I mean, is there some ambiguity here, which may depend on initial conditions or so, or, but I would think still that you would get one definite answer. Is that that we haven't found it yet, or what is the problem here?
Yeah. No, I see what you're driving at, and I agree with what you're saying, that if we can decide on what the relevant physics is, then there will be a definite answer for eccentricity damping or growth. So with the simplest kind of model is to consider a 2D disk with a constant kinematic viscosity, Navier-Stokes viscosity, and no bulk viscosity. And in that case, the circular disk is unstable to developing an eccentricity. So eccentricity is excited in the disk on small scales. And that may or may not be a valid result. Through trying to model slightly more faithfully the dynamics of turbulent stresses in the disk, I came to a different conclusion. But that remains to be tested. I think it would be good to look at, you know, dedicated numerical simulations just of eccentric disks to see what's really going on there in a turbulent case.
So, to understand you correctly, in a Navier-Stokes listless disk, you would expect eccentricity to grow.
Well, I think you've even shown this yourself in your own calculations with with Ronald Schmidt, isn't it?
I would can say this more clearly. I always see, or we have seen damage to eccentricity, like Richard can of course say more detailed things here, but for Jupiter type, we have to specify the last name. For a Jupiter type planet, in the viscous disk, there seems to be damage. This is what we find. I don't know whether it depends on 2D, 3D.
What
in terms of scale heights? Well, I haven't done a run with 2,000 radial grid cells. It's quite a tall order to do that, but
you probably don't need to do, presumably you don't need to do over many meters, right? If you just focus on a smaller number.
Yeah.
But you can look at one at a time, right?
Yeah, you do the one at a time, but you also
I mean, that's a very tall order, of course, when you have this overlapping resonant region. Maybe I should just say a few words about some fairly recent runs which I've been doing, which are certainly open to criticism. These have about 1,000 cells in radius rather than 2,000, so maybe we're a factor of two off. There's some quite interesting behavior. If you start off with something, you allow a disk to form a gap in a circular orbit, and then you, once you feel the gap has reached a steady state structure, or quasi-steady state, you then perturb the planet into an eccentric orbit. In the case of one Jupiter mass planets in fairly standard disk models, you always find that the eccentricity damps, whether or not you start off with an eccentricity of 0.05 or 0.2 or 0.5, it doesn't matter, it always goes down. But there does seem to be a change in behavior when you go to higher masses. And I think this is relating to something that Gordon was mentioning, that the disk itself becomes eccentric. And so there's a kind of coupling between an eccentric disk and the planet, which can actually then go back and drive the planet into a, not a high eccentricity orbit, but into an eccentric orbit which is comparable to what it started off with. But if you run the simulations over very long time scales, then you find that there's a slow decay of the eccentricity of the system. And that seems to be a reasonably robust result. Certainly what one can't do with these models, is my feeling, is that you cannot get eccentricities as observed in the extrasolar planetary systems. Eccentricities of 0.4 or 0.5, in my opinion, are beyond what you can do with a disk. You could possibly get something like about 0.1, but probably no more than that. So if one's looking for a robust mechanism for explaining the eccentricities of extrasolar planets, I think one has to look elsewhere, not with disk models. Yeah. Sorry?
Well, it's a question of when does the planet actually traverse the gap and start entering the disk, at which case the sort of quasi-analytical calculations probably don't mean very much, because the gas flow structure is very strongly perturbed in the resonant overlap region by the planet actually going into that region. So once you have the planet actually entering the disk, physically entering the gaseous disk and traversing the gap due to its eccentric orbit, then the dynamics change quite considerably.
Okay. Non-linear dissipation. Some of the dynamicists may be interested in addressing the issue of what happens if you have lots of high inclinations or inclination excitation on the long run. Yes. I was hoping to get you out of your closet shell, shy closet.
Sorry, good luck.
Okay. Is there any other comments that on this particular topic? Go ahead. It's the eccentricity aspect that he's talking about. He's talking inclination aspect where the self-gravity becomes...
No, eccentricity.
Yeah, okay. Say a little louder so people back there can hear.
I simply said that self-gravity was not yet included in any of the simulations, so it remains to be seen what happens when that's included.